What was it like to hear about the JFK assassination? Or America's triumph over Hitler? Or seeing Queen at Live Aid? Our past is a collection of stories that brings us to now. Welcome to the Eyewitness History Podcast, where we view history through the eyes of the people that watch the events that shaped our world. Here's your host, Josh Cohen, and these are their stories.
Hello, listeners. This is your host, Josh Cohen, here with a short announcement. As many of you will undoubtedly know, I am a member of a podcast network called the Parthenon Podcast Network, which includes James Early and his podcast, Key Battles of American History, Scott Rank and his podcast, History Unplugged, as well as Richard Lim and his podcast, This American President. It also includes the podcast History of the Papacy, which is hosted by my friend Steve Guerra. I'd like to introduce a short clip to you from that podcast entitled Pizza, Pinocchio, and the Papacy, Finding the Very Best and Very Worst of Italy. And now I give you my friend and fellow Parthenon podcast podcaster, Steve Guerra.
I wonder, what I was always thinking is, with Pius IX, the deal that the Italian government gives him is probably about as good of a deal as you can absolutely give someone. There, you can have this bit of land. It's not a ton of land, but it's his own. It's his own property. The papacy gets to control certain churches around the city. They didn't really have to do any of that, but they also knew that there's a lot of Catholics around, and if they're too tough on him, that it's going to play well. But every single, I think that Pius IX, I don't think he was a brilliant tactician. I don't think he was a brilliant person with any of the political person, but I think he really understood messaging and the public relations. He won the PR battle because he could explain his situation in a minute, but it took them 3 minutes to explain theirs. And even though their position was really reasonable in a lot of ways, they couldn't get the message across. There was a person who said that if the person who takes 3 minutes to explain their position is never going to beat the person who can explain theirs in one. He had a very straightforward narrative that I'm a prison of the Vatican, and it played well to the people throughout the entire Catholic world who weren't there, didn't see all of the nuance, and they didn't really have to understand the nuance because he gave a very straightforward narrative that I'm a prisoner, this is all persecution. They really couldn't argue against that. What do you think? Would you push back at all at the, or do you think that it's, he won the propaganda victory, he won the public relations victory?
Oh, yeah, I agree with you 100%. Yeah, I mean, considering the mess that was Italian politics at this time, it wouldn't have been hard to win any sort of battle against such a state, especially, I mean, it was true, everything he was saying. He was technically a prisoner. He did have his temporal authority removed. He did, all this stuff did happen. It's not like he was lying about it. He didn't make it up. He didn't blow the wall in the Aurelian walls. That was all the Italian government. And the Italian government deserves a lot of the criticism for the way they handled taking Rome, how they handled taking Venice, because they could have taken Venice peacefully, but they chose not to. They wanted to have a war because that's what they felt would unite the country. If they had some common enemy to rally around, then Italians could finally be made. But in the end, it ended up hurting them even more. And you see the immense power that the church still holds in Italy. I mean, since the 1929 Concordat with the fascists, the Italian Catholic Church has been the church religion of Italy, literally.
I think to this day they have to have a cross in each classroom. And there's in a secular school that that's how deeply ingrained it came in. And it's really that that Pius IX was able, he was so intransigent, it really, it worked in his favor being So absolutely, he would not budge at any point, even though he was really on the, he lost all the, you know, all, battle after battle after battle, physical, yeah, you know, actual literal battle, but also political battle, but he was still able to come out on top. It's a pretty amazing story when you think of it.
He lost all the battles, but he won the war. I mean, that's there's plenty of examples of that throughout history. Definitely. But yeah, with the passing of all these people.
Yeah, that's a big move. Everybody's gone now.
Everyone dies within like 5 years. I mean, there's the king, there's the general, there's the pope, and Garibaldi dies a little bit after that too. So there's these four massive chess pieces that just fell down, and the left in power is left to pick up the pieces. They are able to hyperdrive the cult of the state now, because the king was able to do a lot more in his death than he did when he was actually alive to unite the country. I mean, in his life, he was kind of like a silly guy. Like there was criticism against him. He had like dye running down his hair into his shirt because he colored his hair. He was an infamous adulterer. I mean, he was joked as literally the father of the nation. Like that's what people would joke about him as. And this was the way that he was viewed. And in his death, 200,000 people went to visit his funeral or went along with it on the way to Rome. And 6 years later, there was another pilgrimage of the same amount of people on Rome to celebrate the king's death. And replacing him was his first son, Umberto. He chose Umberto the first. Thankfully, he didn't choose Umberto the fourth, which a lot of Piedmontese people wanted so they could continue the line of Savoy. But he luckily chose Umberto the first. And the second he's in power, the new political situation shows itself. He's nearly assassinated by a knife wielding assailant. The queen, his first cousin, has to throw a bouquet of flowers into the assailant's face. And the prime minister, who fought in Garibaldi's campaigns, ends up disarming the guy. And the way this guy's treated, I'm not sure about his name, but if you were to look it up, the way he was treated after the fact, completely, completely horrendous. At first, he was given the death sentence, but they communicated that. They placed him underneath sea level, in a prison underneath sea level, tortured him, abused him for hours, 24 hours solitary confinement. Fishermen around the island where he was interred said they could hear him screaming from the walls. It's really terrible how they treated this guy. And of course, he broke the law. I mean, he tried to kill somebody. But still, it's like, wow, this is the level that the government is ready to go against people who do the wrong thing. And this guy was an anarchist. He believed in the propaganda of the deed, which was a famous it was a famous idea put forward by the Italian John Brown, Carlo Piscani. He said, deeds arise from action, not the other way around. And this was the calling card of decades and decades of anarchist agitation against the powers that be, and multiple, numerous assassination attempts, a lot of them successful. The president of the United States, William McKinley, is killed by an assassin's bullet, as well as the
Garfield. Yeah,
Garfield is killed by an assassin's bullet as well. On top of this, the king of Spain is killed by an assassin. Umberto, he survives this one, but eventually he gets got by an assassin who was also an anarchist. And this was spreading all thanks to a guy named Mikhail Bakunin. He's a very famous Russian anarchist, famous for writing the bread book. I believe that was him, and putting forward the idea that any property whatsoever is theft. So you have the right, being a natural citizen of the world, to put your action to power and take down the powers that be through violence, because that's the only way it's going to happen, at least for these leftists. The main person that Italy now transitions to is Umberto's wife, who, as I said, was his first cousin, Margherita. There's the very famous legend of Margherita, the Margherita pizza, where she had like a pizza contest, and someone brought the pizza with tomato sauce, the cheese, and the basil, which is what is called the Margherita pizza now. And she said, oh, this pleases me the most because it reminds me of the Italian flag. That never happened, but it just shows the level of you know, the occult that was slowly being built around this the state. Now, with Pope Pius's death, Leo XIII ascends as well in Rome. You might want to talk about Leo a little bit. He seems like a very, very interesting character. Definitely a lot more moderate than Pius. He seemed to be on a very level head in terms of, you know, the level of the popes, considering Pope IX, Pius IX, and then following him, Pope Pius X, who was also very illiberal. Leo seems to be a very even keel character in this drama. He eases the papal decree against, secretly, he eases the papal decree against Catholics voting, because for the longest time, Catholics were unallowed to vote, were not allowed to vote. It didn't stop them, obviously. I mean, after the decree was lifted, much longer in the future, the voting numbers didn't change at all. They were the same. So really, Catholics were voting the whole time. But yeah, maybe you can talk about Leo XIII, his...
Well, we can keep, in a lot of ways, Leo XIII is beyond where we're going to be going. But I think that it shows that there is a modernization going. All of these popes still kind of clung to that idea that they were prisoners of the Vatican, and it mm-hmm. won't be until that Concordat in 1929. But things are starting to change in that the papacy is becoming more modern, and they're still holding on to some of those vestiges of that we're prisoners of the Vatican, and that some of these ideas of clinging to the, because it took such a long time for the papacy to enter modernity, that there's still going to be vestiges of these old ideas that they've hung on to of being against everything modern, but they're slowly turning into the papacy that we'll see today, that they're more theological, it's more based on the religion, and they're kind of you know, to use the modern parlance, they're more of an NGO, a non-governmental organization, that they're going to have this soft power. And from my readings of Leo XIII, he's easing into those ideas, and it's a transition into the popes that we'll see in the 50s and the 60s, and even up until John Paul II of... Yeah. They don't have any secular power, but they have a soft power. We're starting to see that in the end of the 19th century, going into the early 20th century. You can see where that's going to come from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you see his teaming up with more liberals against socialism, because socialism by this point has become the number one boogeyman. Before, it used to be liberalism and railroads and gaslighting or whatever. Now it was the overwhelming force of collectivization, which was really, really, it was going crazy in places like Romagna, which was very famous for having a lot of agitation. And these anarchists and socialist ideas worked super well in Italy because they were so well known for having violent, violent peasant uprisings. And this is throughout time. I mean, you can look at any century and see a dozen different ones.
I chuckle a little bit when you say gaslighting. It's literal gaslighting. It's the It's lighting with natural gas or whatever. I don't remember what the exact chemical gas is, but that was something that that popes in the early 1800s fought against, of putting in modern things like gaslight. And I mean, we're not even talking electricity. We're talking about just putting in railroads. Like you had mentioned earlier that, there was almost zero mileage of track, railroad track in the Papal States. And that's how far behind they were, the sections of Italy, that they didn't have canals. They didn't have all these technologies that in the early 1800s made places like Great Britain explode and industrially, and parts of Germany and parts of even Northern Italy, the United States, all these basic technologies of gaslight, of railroads, of canals. They didn't have any of it. They're starting off at basically zero.
Yeah, it's very much like a system of mercantilism. I mean, you see, my next series is on Puerto Rico, So I'm very in depth in the colonial sort of mind games that were played. But Italy was a perfect example of colonialism on the continent of Europe. I mean, their resources were sent away. The silk that was, I mean, Italy controls maybe a third of the silk production of the entire world. That was all sent away. The exports of wool and wine, they were all sent away. There was no resource building inside the country itself. It was all sent to foreign markets. It was sent to the metropolis of, you know, Spain or the metropole of France in the Napoleonic times or Austria. And this is how it remains so poor. And on top of it, like you were saying, the theological state that literally existed right in the smack dab middle of it, that kept the two halves from really connecting with each other in any sort of economic way. It's a good way for me to transition now to Italian foreign policy, because you see Italian foreign policy at this time, it's in the left, they support basically the French. That's their whole thing. They're Francophiles. They send France almost 50% of all Italian exports. So France is the number one power in terms of the versus Italy. But they see very quickly that this relationship starts to go sour. In 1878, there's the Congress of Berlin, which is more or less a partitioning of the Ottoman Empire. There's massive rebellions in modern day Bulgaria, which leads to the state of Bulgaria that we know it today, but it's massively expanded. There are Greeks and Macedonians and Serbians who are part of Bulgaria who want nothing to do with this country. So the people, the powers of Europe come together. They set about sorting this out. They decrease the size of Bulgaria to its modern day borders. Britain is given Cyprus, super important strategic island in the middle of the Mediterranean. France is secretly given the go-ahead to invade all of North Africa, basically. Russia gets Bulgaria recognized, obviously. Austria becomes the protectorate of Bosnia, Herzegovina. At this, the Italian diplomat asks for Trentino. If Austria is going to get aggrandized in the east, we should get a little bit of Austria in the west. This is, after all, probably 50-50 split, 50% Italian speaking, 50% German speaking. At this, the Russian ambassador basically pulls a joke on his expense. He said, "Oh, what battle did Italy lose that they want more land?" and this pisses off the diplomat of Italy. And for the rest of the Congress, he doesn't assert his position. Italy's left with nothing. They're hoping to get at least Tunisia, but by 1882, that gets invaded by France, and general conflict between the two countries is stopped barely. I mean, it was almost a full general war in North Africa over Tunisia. Tunisia itself was a huge part of the Italian diaspora. There were thousands and thousands of Italians living in Tunisia under the Bey's protection. Not only that, economic interests in Tunisia were astronomical. The Italian economists and early nationalists wanted Tunisia, not just because of the things I mentioned, but because it used to be the home of Carthage. It used to be the breadbasket of the entire Roman Empire. This was considered to have to be, it was a staple of Italy to control this. They needed this. This was a part of who they were. And this is where the irredentist movement really begins.
Thanks for listening to this episode. If you'd like to support Eyewitness History, the easiest way to do that would be to subscribe to the show on the podcast player of your choice and leave a review. For more information on Eyewitness History, along with show notes and links to resources, go to ParthenonPodcast.com, where you can also listen to some other great podcasts by the Parthenon Podcast Network, such as Scott Rank's History Unplugged, Steve Guerra's History of the Papacy, James Early's Key Battles of American History, and Richard Lim's This American President, along with many others. Thank you.
The Historical Jesus Podcast is the sweeping saga of the life and times of Galilean Jesus of Nazareth, as well as the faith, religion, and church founded to honor and disseminate his acts and teachings. Join me, Mark Vinette, on this fascinating journey through time, exploring the many great works of Christian theology, literature, architecture, music, and art inspired by the words and deeds of Jesus Christ.